This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
This podcast is brought to you by JetBrains. JetBrains are moving on with their renowned Visual Studio productivity tool, ReSharper. Early access program for the upcoming ReSharper 6 is now open, highlighted with long-awaited support for JavaScript and CSS, plus code inspections for VB.NET. Support for Razor View Engine is coming up as well, and many new features will be revealed soon. Go try out the early builds of ReSharper 6 at jetbrains.net/resharper.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on November 3, 2010. Tonight we're talking to Kelly Summers. And Kelly, can you introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, I'm Kelly Summers. I'm a mobile developer for a large org. I work on many of the popular mobile platforms that are out there today. I also have all kinds of random dev projects going on in my spare time. I love trying to solve something challenging or enjoy keeping up with all the new technologies and trends. And I'm really excited to be on your show, so thank you for having me.
Great. Okay. We had several people recommend that we get you on our show, and I think one thing that caught a lot of people's attention to start with was your post titled, What Fuels My Passion for Technology and Writing Code? And it has a big picture of Shakespeare at the top. Actually, a video. I thought that was pretty interesting. What can you summarize, like, what was on your mind as you were writing that?
Sure. So I had a gap between blog posts, and I just felt like I needed to do a blog post one day, and I kind of just asked Twitter, what should I blog about? And one of my friends, Keith, on Twitter suggested, why don't you just blog about, you know, why you enjoy what you do, because it seems like you enjoy it. So I decided to just, start writing, and that was the first post that I really didn't edit too much. I just started typing what was on my mind. And I just kind of explained how it's kind of been like a snowball effect, how like I enjoy creating things and solving problems, and it's been getting, like, my hunger for solving those problems has just been getting, you know, bigger and bigger. And I just really enjoy development on all kinds of different angles. Like, I like mobility is really fun because it's very fast paced. But even, like, you know, if a customer has a specific problem, it's really fun to, like, solve it for them, and then, you know, you're solving a business solution for them. So I just really enjoy creating new things, basically.
So you got a lot of feedback on that post. What did you find that was interesting? Did you find people generally agreeing with you, or, you know, having other similar experiences?
Yeah, actually, the one thing that probably stood out the most was I mentioned how, you know, I'm up late often working on code, and whether it's my own, you know, projects or work-related stuff. And that was probably the thing that got commented the most was, you know, a whole bunch of people saying, yeah, I work, you know, way too late, and I'm always tired, and I've always got getting ideas and stuff like that. One interesting thing was Glenn Block of Microsoft. He really related to my story in my blog, and he kind of did a little blog post in kind of response. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah, Glenn's fun. Whenever I'm up late coding, he's always on. And it's always, I don't know, he's fun to chat with.
I think he's the only person that I've met so far that actually is up later than me.
Yeah, and it's dangerous to get into a discussion with him, because he's more equipped than I am to discuss anything.
He's also the one person that talks faster than I do.
Well, you've got to get Hanselman on a late night session. And then just when you think you're up late and it's really late, you'll see emails. He'll start complaining or saying that emails from Scott Guthrie are coming into him. And you think that must be a prerequisite that you have insomnia to work at Microsoft.
Or you think these people are vampires, but then you see them during the day too. So,
yeah, they've got some kind of special sun cream, I think.
Oh, man. So you were saying that Glenn Block was commenting and stuff. And I noticed in your post and a lot of the people that commented were Twitter followers. And that was something you'd also mentioned beforehand, was like your experiences in kind of getting involved in the development community. A lot of that's been, I don't know, like Twitter's been a big part of that.
Yeah, Twitter's been like amazing. So over a year ago, I had nothing. Like I had no blog. I had no Twitter. I had Facebook, which is kind of funny. I don't have Facebook anymore, but I have Twitter. And so, yeah, I joined. Somebody convinced me to join Twitter, and I joined. And I think, like most people, it starts like really slow because nobody's listening to you. So you're tweeting, and you're like, hello, is anybody out there? And so I was applying for a new job about a year ago from now. And I did this... I wanted to practice being in interviews and being in those, you know, awkward situations. So I just tweeted that, you know, can some developers just send me some questions and just random questions that I can try and answer just so I can practice being under fire. And I think it was Bill Reese, he retweeted it and he had a whole bunch of .NET developers following him. And I just started getting like questions from all kinds of people. Like Scott Guthrie sent me a question on implementing, like, why should you implement the dispose pattern and stuff like that. And I just got like hundreds of tweets on questions, and it was like really great practice. And I created like a cheat sheet that I studied for days before the interviews. And I ended up getting a job in the end. And after that, I just kind of snowballed. I got more followers and stuff like that. And later on, Mary Jo Foley asked me to do an interview for an article she was going to do on her blog on ZDNet, which was cool, about Windows Phone developers, Windows Phone 7 phone developers, sorry. And yeah, it's just been really crazy. And then like my passion for coding blog post after that. And then, you know, Glenn Block found that blog from Twitter. And it's just been like that 1 year of being on Twitter has been probably the most like amazing collaborative experience I've ever had. It's really neat.
You know, that's kind of interesting because I talk to people that are, you know, like they're just starting their blogs or they're just kind of, you know, and they're like, hey, how do I get into this? You know, like, how do I get involved? And I think like what you're saying is probably, you know, what you know, is kind of the general experience. Like you just kind of, you get into conversations, and then of course it helps to know what you're talking about and, you know, to like have something to say. Like, it's not just jumping on Twitter and being like, woohoo, party, party, you know, but like, I think having these conversations with people on Twitter, and then over time, like the network builds out and stuff. It's just fun to, you know, like watch it happen. Like I was explaining Twitter to other friends in different industries that are getting started, you know, and explaining kind of like, here's what this is, and here's a retweet, and here's why you care about it, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, I tell people that want to get on Twitter, and they get on, and, you know, nothing happens. And I say, just, like, tweet about what you're working on, because those keywords will start to build, you know, people that are searching those keywords or hashtags and all that stuff. And it starts really slow, but once it starts rolling, it really starts rolling fast.
So you had another post that got even more attention, which was this one about the desktop luster. It sounds like a product or something, the desktop luster. The official title was the desktop OS starting to bore me and how do we get the luster back? And I thought, I mean, before talking about that, I thought one thing that was interesting was how you introduced the post with a tweet. And then at the end of it, you kind of summed it up with, you know, here's the conversation from Twitter. And again, like I'm finding like a lot of the time that I think the most interesting kind of posts or conversations that I see start with, you know, a Twitter conversation. You get people involved and different viewpoints and stuff. So what was your thinking there? You were saying that because of your mobile development, that the desktop development experience was not as interesting.
It's not so much the development, because we have good tools on the desktop like we do on mobile, but I sometimes feel that now on the mobile OSs and the mobile apps, people are trying to do interesting like user experiences, like in Tweety, or now it's renamed to Twitter on iPhone and Twitter on iPad. Now they're doing some interesting ways that you interact with the UI in the app. And, you know, the different mobile OSs, you know, Windows Phone 7 has the panorama, and with that background and the foreground, they kind of shift at different speed. iPhone has their home screens, and WebOS has their, you know, unique user experience. And it feels like people are trying harder at doing unique things. And the desktop just seems like it's, you know, we have our taskbar, we have our start menu, or you have the dock on OS X. And we do little user experience tweaks, but it doesn't feel like anybody's really trying to change things too much. So that was kind of my goal of that blog post, was saying, like, I think we could probably do more. We just stopped trying.
So, like, one thing you mentioned was the kind of desktop as a, I don't know, like the you looked at, here's what's available when you glance at your phone, and kind of the heads up display versus desktop on a PC being kind of pretty similar. You've got your taskbar and, like you're saying, just an empty desktop. Are there ideas that you would have? Like, I'm seeing one, which is kind of the iPad type experience, which is more, you know, and I guess Apple's since then talked about doing that, like bringing that app, I don't know. What do you call it, Kevin? This app thing to the desktop. You know what I'm talking about? No.
The app kit or whatever?
Yeah, I don't
know. Like, so you can run the iOS apps on OS X?
Yeah. I guess I'm just trying to think, like, what is the experience there? Like, what did you have ideas there about, you know, what kind of information you'd want to see at a glance on a desktop?
I think what we look at on the phone is, like, the information we're looking for is very similar to what we use on a desktop, but how we display it on a desktop or how we integrate it is, you know, very different. Like, if you think of on iPhone or iPad, when you get a new email, there's a push notification, and, you know, it shows, like, the badge number that you have 5 new email, and you don't actually have to really be, like, having the mail app open. But on the desktop, we're always running Outlook, and that's the only way that we can get notifications. So it's kind of, and if the Outlook icon on the desktop never says, you know, 3 new emails, you only get the little toaster pop-up that comes up. So I think the interaction on phones, we could learn a lot from that and put it, like, onto the desktop and show things a bit more. Windows 7, I think, is probably done a little bit of that with the new taskbar that it has. It can show, you know, different things. It can flash and show a number, and you can have the little pop-up preview window do things. So there's some things there. But if you look at, like, our desktop is closer to in the original iPhone home screen before it had any of the badges. It's just a bunch of icons. It just, we can't go to a second and third screen. It really doesn't do anything. And with Vista, they introduced, like, gadgets, which I think was, they had the right intention, but there was no real user experience that was consistent. It was just build, you know, 50 gadgets that look all entirely different than the other gadgets. But the nice thing about, like, if you think of Windows Phone 7, is they're giving you that information on the home screen in the way of hubs, but they're all somewhat similar. They have different content, but they have this similar styling. And I think they could do something like that for Windows.
Yeah, that's interesting. As you were talking about, too, before with the the idea of notifications, that there are systems like Growl. There's probably some others out there that are, like, they're notification APIs that different people have built, and they're just open source projects. But that kind of thing, too, where it's like, you know, in addition to desktop things, but the notifications, it seemed like, you know, common systems for a lot of those give you, like, make it easy to get those notifications and things, but also to have the consistency.
Yeah.
Well, so one of the things I thought was interesting about that post was that it was very Windows-centric, and that's not a slam or anything. That's just, it was mainly looking at things like the taskbar and the Windows tray, some of the things that don't really exist in the Linux, Unix, and OS X, OS X. Geez, we're going to get more calls about that, aren't we? world. And one of the things that I always found frustrating on Windows, and that it still doesn't really have, with at least natively, not without a third-party add-in, is something like Expose, where you hit a key or you move your mouse to a hotspot, and instantly you can see all the windows that are open. And there's even a way where if you're within an app, you can see all, and it has multiple windows open, you can just see all the windows that are open with that app, just with a single key press or, like I said, a mouse moving to a hotspot. And Linux has had virtual desktops for years. I remember using Fluxbox, and I guess that's kind of gone by the wayside, but OpenBox now. It's a very minimalist window manager that has multiple desktops that allow you to quickly, you know, organize your workplace. And Windows still doesn't have that. One of the other things that I saw on Linux First was the idea of putting status widgets on the desktop itself. So you could see CPU utilization, you see network usage as a graph. OpenStep had that. And NextStep, they had the little, I don't remember what they're called. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? They had they call it the slit in Flexbox, but it was something else where you could put these little, I think there was window manager, little applets almost that would fit in there.
I remember that.
Yeah, mounting and unmounting and things like that. It's kind of, this is basically like the gadgets on Vista and the dashboard on OS X.
But these are things you mount onto your taskbar.
Well, onto the window manager bar. It wasn't quite a taskbar. Like I said, in Fluxbox, it was just the slit. So it was just this floating area where you could put these uniform-sized widgets that would then display one. Like they had one that scrolled the matrix kind of a screensaver thing. But it would get more intense the more CPU utilization that was used. They had another one that was a washing machine that I always thought was kind of fun that would symbolize, you know, CPU utilization. The faster the washer was running, the more CPU you're using. So just kind of dumb things like that. But it did make using those systems a lot more friendly. Even the 3D flip thing that Vista introduced, it was still kind of useless because you couldn't see all the windows at once. So you had to flip through them and look at them at this weird skewed angle. So it's like somebody walked past an OS X desktop in an Apple store and saw Exposé and thought, oh, we can do that on Windows. And then, you know, got it wrong. But so,
yeah.
One of the things
you do have Alt Tab in Windows shows you the open windows, but it doesn't. Yeah, it shows thumbnails on them.
Yeah, it shows them. What I think they're running thumbnails. Mm-hmm. So if you have a movie running now, finally, and that was one thing that was always kind of handy too. So if you had some web page that was going to take a long time to load, you just start it and move to another window, and then use Exposé or Alt Tab and check on it, see if it was done loading yet. Finally.
I really liked Spaces in OS X. I wasn't really a big fan of virtual desktops before, like, because I started with Linux when I was young, and the virtual desktops I really didn't get attached to, but for some reason when I started using a MacBook for iPhone development, I found Spaces just really useful to flip through different screens.
But one thing that still kind of permeates the whole desktop experience is the idea that you're using a mouse or some kind of pointer. And I do think that Apple has the right idea that people don't want to sit there and poke at their screen horizontally, vertically. I do think that the trackpad and being a multi-touch pad is the way to go. But it's still very focused on pointing at things.
Yeah, one of the things I mentioned in my blog was I think we could probably do a little bit more with the mouse and keyboard too, and that's another, like, one of my feelings that we just stopped trying to do things. Like Linux, ever since I started, you could hit the Alt key and drag a window without having to click the title bar. You just had to click anywhere in the window and you could move it. So you can, you know, move your windows really quickly, not having to be too accurate with your mouse. Mm-hmm. So I think that was kind of, you know, onto something. You could, like, what if you could resize our windows by your cursor just had to be in a quadrant of the window. It doesn't have to, you know, go to the little corner and wait for the cursor to change and then drag it. You know, the bigger the hit spot, the better, and you can, you know, do stuff a lot faster.
Yeah, that's definitely something you see with, like, I think because people are using phones and, you know, smaller touch devices, and they have to be more forgiving. And so the things like, you know, like when you're typing on an on-screen keyboard, like the keys get bigger to give you some sort of, you know, like that kind of thing. And then when you're on a desktop, it's like you're saying, it's, you have tiny little, you know, 16 pixels, you know, to get into in order to resize.
Well, they're starting to get that way with the multi-touch pads, like the Bamboo trackpad and the MacBook trackpad.
Yep. You know, one thing that Scott was mentioning was the idea of desktop managers. And there's a desktops, I guess it's version 1.02. It's from SysInternals. And it's, yeah, I tried it and it works pretty well. It's on TechNet. And I don't know, I mess with it. You know, it works pretty well as far as like being able to have multiple desktops and use them as workspaces and that kind of thing. But I think that it's something where I kind of have to train myself to actually use it, or I don't really think about it. And I think a problem is that it's something that you have to go out and install rather than, you know, it's like just shipped with Windows and you say, hey, cool, hit, you know, window whatever, and it does it.
Yeah.
Well, one thing that I always thought was interesting were these the Linux and Unix guys who would run no graphical Windows system whatsoever. They would either use screen or there's one that's based on like some kind of rodent name, and I don't remember what it's called. But basically it's just, you know, a text-based windowing system. And they would just do everything through the keyboard, resizing and everything. I thought that's the way that some of the early computers were. And, you know, you typed everything out. And I just thought that was an interesting idea. And the more I work around system administrators and network type people, the more I see them using PowerShell and Bash versus, you know, right clicking on things to set permissions and.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny how the industry is kind of like, you know, the Linux people are still trying to find, you know, a really sleek looking desktop.
Yeah.
And then the Microsoft people are building PowerShell because people want light servers with no UI, you know, consuming memory. So you have like the server core with PowerShell.
Yeah, yeah. You know, one thing that somebody taught me early on was the whole, you hit Alt Space, and that brings up the move, resize, and all that. And so, like, you can get pretty, but it's not discoverable. But if you know about it, you hit Alt Space, and then say M, Alt Space M, and it brings up the arrow keys, and you can quickly move, or Alt Space S, and you get the. But you got to know about it, you know, and that's not something that you know about that much. And then it's getting less and less obvious as they kind of hide those things. Like in IE9, you don't see any of that.
Yeah, those are shortcuts from like Windows 3.1,
yep,
aren't they?
Yes, they are. So, yeah. Well, so let me see. We've got. So you were saying that some of this was in reaction to. Oh, are we done with the desktop? Do you guys? I mean, this is off the record. Just wondering. Yes.
I think we can all agree that the desktop still kind of sucks today.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
but it's the best piece of crap we got.
Yeah.
Actually, I have one interesting comment. So I see, and this might be a good segue maybe to the next topic. I kind of see mobile devices having desktops eventually. So you're going to plug it into your dock, and you know, you can just go to your desk and just put it in the dock, and you'll be able to, you know, have a lightweight desktop environment where you might have a taskbar or something that's like that, and you know, you can do some web browsing, maybe some office type stuff, and then you know, you can just unplug it, take off.
They had one a while ago. It was the pre-Origami thing. Do you remember what it was called? Like the OQQ or something like that?
OQO?
OQO?
Yeah.
OQO, yeah. The thing that the Vulcan guy, Paul Allen.
That was the UMPC.
Funded it. Yeah, yeah. And the idea was that you could plug them into a dock and it would be hooked up to a mouse and keyboard, and you could use them like you would a desktop.
You know what I'd like better is if I just like when it's in proximity to my computer or whatever, that it just becomes like I can drag stuff from my computer onto my phone and vice versa. You know, like it's
yeah.
I was talking about that the other day actually, yeah.
Oh, sure you were.
Well, because I was talking, like, Dropbox is kind of like that, but mm-hmm. it's not really integrated with your OS or your phone. It's like, oh, I gotta, you know, open a folder, drop stuff in, and then I have to open an app. Like, I think what you're thinking is, like, you know, you're browsing a web page and you need to leave. You could just drag IE somewhere, and then it shows up on your phone. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah, and they've got, you know, they've got extensions like Chrome to Phone and stuff like that. Or, you know, I don't know, what are these, Instapaper and Read It Later, and the, you know, things There are management systems you can use, but it would be nice if that was just kind of like, it just, you know, you just smoothly drag something on and off. And as I'll be happy with it as long as it doesn't require me to, like, use some stupid proprietary cable and run some stupid proprietary sync app, because I hate all that stuff.
Well, so it's a stupid proprietary thing, but that's kind of what they're going with the new Apple TV and the iPads and the MacBooks. The idea that you can be watching something on your iPad, stop, and start it up where you were on your Apple TV.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you know, a very limited use case where, you know, I got to watch a movie or something from iTunes. But yeah, I could see extending that kind of thing. And like Kelly mentioned, I use Dropbox in kind of the same way. There are a couple of Dropbox-enabled apps that will save docs to your Dropbox, and you can edit them on your desktop, and then pick up your iPhone and open up an app that will read from your Dropbox file. There's a PDF reader called GoodReader that can integrate with Dropbox. So I upload lots of ebooks to my Dropbox thing, and then I can read them over using GoodReader straight from Dropbox without having to open it up and do anything kind of funky there. And I think that's going to become more prevalent, especially as if Windows Phone 7 ever gets its act together with Link and Sync and Mesh and whatever else.
Yeah, I agree. I think that Sync is, like, it's beautiful if you don't have to think about it. And if you have to think about it, like, I dislike programs where I have to run a sync app to, you know, if I want to copy music onto this device, I have to run the sync app, and oh no, I got to run updates, and where's that cable and all that stuff. But like sync stuff that just kind of magically works is really nice. Like, I edit the podcast using Audacity, and I'm using what's it called these days? Windows Live Mesh, Beta Refresh 2, Sync Edition, whatever it is. But
Link Edition.
Right.
Link Edition with LYNC server.
That's right. Yeah. But what's nice is, like, so I'm editing on my computer, and then I'm like, okay, I'm going to go sit on the couch and pretend to watch, you know, TV with the wife. And then, like, it's up to date on my laptop in the exact spot where I was editing last, same things, you know, everything's same states there. And then I work on it, and then later, you know, it just kind of like keeps everything all. So, I mean, that's really enjoyable. And then I could see the same thing if it was on my phone and I can preview it. You know, that's the kind of thing that starts to feel like those things that Microsoft is really good at, those technology videos, like the Microsoft, you know, vision of the future, you know, where they have, like the courier tablet was, that kind of thing. You know? But that's some of the, like, vision stuff that I do think is really cool. I just like to see more of it, you know, where it's like everything's just kind of magically in sync without me having to worry about it.
Yeah, I think, like, the AirPlay from Apple is kind of, like, probably their first step into trying to integrate. Because their devices really don't integrate too much besides syncing with iTunes and being able to plug in, you know, your iPad against your same iTunes library as your iPhone. But they don't really speak together until now with AirPlay.
Mm-hmm.
But I think whoever figures out how to do this, you're right, like, if you don't have to do anything for sync to happen, then it just feels natural.
Mm-hmm.
I think the OS maker has to almost build like an API that apps can just leverage. Instead of syncing files, it's more like integrating with an API of some sort. So, like, if you're writing a blog post and then you just have to take off, you don't have to, like, drag something somewhere. You don't have to save it to a Dropbox. You just leave it, but it follows you.
Yeah.
You don't think about it. It just goes with you. And I think whoever figures that out is going to be, you know, on the next step of mobility where, you know, all these devices you have, and it kind of sounds cliche, but, like, I think Ray Ozzie had the three screens in the cloud or whatever. I think that's kind of what he means by that.
Mm-hmm.
You just leverage all your different devices, and you don't have to worry about any of them. It just happens. It just works.
Well, so to kind of sync back, not sync, no, we don't want to sync anymore, to kind of link back to what we were talking about earlier with desktops and Growl specifically, when you're talking about, you know, just having an API there that people can use, that's interesting from the standpoint of Growl, where Growl and what's the Windows equivalent?
Growl.
Do you remember?
Well,
Growl for Windows.
Yeah, exactly.
Growl for Windows.
I think there was something else. It was like Prowl or something, whatever. But right. I think a lot of people are just using Growl for Windows.
But so the idea is you install this thing once, and then developers can write their apps to self-register and say, okay, they've got Growl installed, so I'm going to register myself Snap with Growl, and then I will use Growl as my pop-up notifications instead. Mm-hmm. And I think that at having a syncing API that's like that, where your app would, you know, when it gets installed or starts up for the first time, it says, oh, look, this computer has this sync API on it, so I'm going to register myself as a consumer of this, and then I'll just start using its features behind the scenes without the user having to configure anything or initiate a sync or, you know, anything like that. They can certainly do that in the app if the app designer wants to make it like that, but for the most part, you know, it's just seamless to the user. There is no configuring. There is no yada yada right. getting the stuff all set.
What's your API key? Browse to this file. What's your, you know, all that? It just,
exactly.
just works.
It just works.
Yeah. That was something we did in that witty Twitter client was we implemented Growl. And it was cool. I mean, it was, you did have to implement a few things, but it was nice because exactly that, you got these nicer configurable notifications and they all matched how you'd already set, like, I forget what you could do with Growl, but you can say, like, I don't want notifications, blah, 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 you know, in these conditions, and you don't get any of them. So that's cool. That's a tangent.
We don't want to go off on a tangent.
Well, it's interesting that we kind of doubled back because, well, so we're talking about, you know, Mesh. A lot of these things were APIs that were in Mesh, and didn't seem to really catch on. Like, you know, the whole idea.
Yeah, I think they need to connect the dots better. These are, you know, these things that are separate that don't really connect very well. And if it's difficult for people to, I think Mesh, like when I saw some demos of Mesh, and one guy built his car computer with Mesh, and the demo was amazing. It was a Microsoft guy, and he put in like a cheap computer in his car dash, and it had Wi-Fi, and when he drove into his driveway, it would sync all his files, like all his music.
Oh, nice.
And, like, you know, agendas on where he was going to drive and maps and all that kind of stuff. Then he would drive off, and he would have all the files, and he didn't have to worry about the syncing as long as he had Wi-Fi somewhere. It worked. But he had to do, you know, a bunch of development to make that work. I think for it to be, like, for things like for sync or mesh or whatever they call it now to work, it needs to be like super simple for app developers to leverage.
Yeah. I think one thing too is the whole like a lot of really cool APIs and things that Microsoft builds or probably other people build, like the APIs are there, but there's no like first implementation. So like some examples are, I really like the whole idea with Windows Card Space or info card, which was like, you know, it was a secure login where I didn't have to type in a password and it could, you know, log me into different websites, could log me into all these different things. And it's similar, kind of like OpenID, but a step further. And it was really cool, but I never saw anyone implement it, you know.
Yeah,
like,
well, with Mesh, I think what they have to do with it is actually use it within their apps.
That's exactly, like, yeah, yeah.
Like, it would be really cool if, when you create a document in Word and you start typing and then you just leave your computer, it's already talking with sync. You don't have to hit file save and tell it to go to a sync folder.
Right.
It just works. And then, you know, if you're out the door and you hop in a taxi, you unlock your phone and then the file is already there. You didn't do anything.
I think you just pointed out a very key thing, which is it seems like a lot of features that people really jump onto are first demonstrated with Office specifically, you know, and it's like once Office does it, then people are like, oh, toolbars, oh, ribbons, oh, this, you know, and then everyone does it. But there's all these features, like I was saying, the Card Space, there's this cool peer-to-peer networking system that came out with Vista that I haven't seen really anybody using. There's tons of different, like, really cool APIs that are available, but it's like until you actually see, like, until it's installed by, like, until there's an actual working application that's installed by default, people don't really, like, latch on to them, it seems like.
So, one of the reasons that I got kind of excited when I saw Mesh demoed at, what was it, PDC 08, I think it was.
It might have even been 07 or 06.
I think it must have been 08 because I've only been to two PDCs, and one was in 2000,
okay,
and the other was 2008. But one of the things that they kept talking about was these ideas of mesh apps. So you'd have these apps that you could install, and say you were storing podcasts on your machine at home, you could log into your mesh via the web, and you could write a podcast player mesh app that would then go and play your podcast from your machine at home or wherever it happened to be. You know, the idea of you didn't have to worry about where the file was stored. You just had to write an app that was aware of, you know, how to get to it through mesh. But the frustrating part for me was, even though I was an MVP at the time, and I knew all these, you know, muckety mucks and was there at PDC, I couldn't find a way to actually get a hold of the freaking SDK and write things. And as far as I know, like, they never made it public. Like, a few select MVPs or insiders or, you know, Microsoft employees or something wrote, like, a demo app, and that was it. And they never publicized it, and I thought it was the coolest part about mesh. You know, yeah, the remote desktop is nice, but you can do that using some open, free and open source VPN stuff now. The whole idea of sharing folders, I mean, Dropbox and Box.net were already out and established pretty much. So that was, you know, even folder share was around. So that was, you know, kind of, sure, whatever, me too. Mm-hmm. But the idea of writing this mesh app that would just kind of live in your mesh itself, and so it would be available on any desktop that you went to that could get to either the mesh website or had mesh installed on it and could access things, you know, without you having to say, oh, it's on this machine in this folder. You just said, oh, here it is in my mesh folder. Go play with this file or go do with this or whatever. And it just, it never took off. And then it went away and it's turned into just another sync framework. What is that? JASF? Yeah. That's one of the reasons that I thought it just never picked up.
Yeah. Yeah. I think with all that stuff, it's like you need to have, I mean, there needs to be a big app that shows it off in order. And in order to do that, then yeah, you do actually need to have something published.
Well, and yeah, the flip side of that is you really need an app in order to prove out the APIs too. You know, otherwise you get kind of half-assed, you know, incomplete stuff.
Yeah, which then goes to, you know, like WPF really seemed to get a lot better when, you know.
Exactly.
Visual Studio.
When they used it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny how they rewrote the text engine when Visual Studio had to use it.
Yeah. So, Kelly, do you do a fair amount, or how much WPF? You do some WPF development, right?
Yeah, I've been doing a lot more recently than I dabbled with it when it first came out because I was super excited, you know, coming from RenForms, being able to, like, do animations and stuff.
Yeah.
So I played with it a little bit at first, and then, but a lot more when I would say production code now than then.
And have you seen, I mean, have things made a big difference in the things that came out with .NET 4?
Unfortunately, I'm kind of restricted to 3.5 still because that's what our product uses. But so I when I first started doing the prototype, I started with 4, and I had things like Visual State Manager and I had like animation easing and stuff like that, and I got spoiled. And then I had to go back to 3.5, and I lost all those things.
Oh, man. Visual State Manager is so nice. It's I remember when Silverlight got that, I was just like, oh, I can take out all this handwritten code and I just define the states.
Yeah, I guess the alternative in 3.5 is a bunch of triggers and stuff, which is okay, but it's definitely not as nice.
Yeah, yeah. So how does the overlap of that fit? You said you'd done some Windows Phone development.
Yeah, I've done a little bit, mostly just kind of playing around to see what the tools are like. I was a little bit familiar with Silverlight, so I knew what to expect from. And, I mean, WPF has a lot of parallels, too, with Blend and you know, how you build controls and stuff like that.
So one thing I was thinking when we were, you know, talking before was that we've had people on the show talking about a lot of different development, mobile development platforms. And in general, there are people like, hey, we know Mono, and here's how Mono works on iPhone, or here's how Mono works on Android, or you know what I mean? And we've had we had a show on native iPhone development. But I think one thing that's unique from your perspective is that you've done production work on a lot of these different phone platforms, right?
Yep. I've done BlackBerry, Windows Mobile, iPhone.
So what were your thoughts on the development experience with, I was thinking specifically with Windows Phone, the new Windows Phone, how that feels to you from a development experience?
I think it's good. I think one thing, in my opinion anyways, Microsoft does really well is developer tools. I don't think anybody really has a tool like Blend for doing animations and stuff like that. So, I mean, Flash Studio has it, but Flash really doesn't have a mobile platform per se for doing like native apps on the phone. So I think Microsoft really has, you know, some good tools with Visual Studio 2010. Blend is good. I think the integration between the two apps could get better. You know, you save your solution, then you go back to Blend, and Blend says, would you like to reload it? So I think they could maybe make that a little smoother.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Blend is a really good designing tool. All the animation stuff is good. The VSM, like we were saying earlier, is good. I'm not a big fan of, like, Interface Builder on iPhone. It's kind of a clunky way of designing UI. It doesn't do any animations. BlackBerry doesn't have a UI designer.
So what do you end up doing then when you're doing BlackBerry development? Is that just hand coding everything?
Most people, yeah. Well, they do have a UI designer, so they shipped, but I think they discontinued it. They shipped actually a Visual Studio plugin at one time, which let you build, they call it forms-based apps. So you actually use the Visual Studio designer, and you could build stuff, and you could target some web services. But it was like super, super simplistic, and nobody really used it, so that's why they discontinued it. And they ship their own IDE, and I'm not sure if they still ship it or not, but nobody uses it because it looks like a text editor from, like, the 80s. And most people use Eclipse and like, a Eclipse plugin, and they, you know, set up all the NAT environment to do all the BlackBerry compilations and stuff. And it's definitely not as smooth. Like, I think we get kind of spoiled with Visual Studio where you just, like, double-click the solution and then you hit build and everything works. Whereas, you know, with Java, you have to kind of wire up your environment for a while before you can even build it.
Right. Yeah. Had you looked at any Android development?
I haven't done Android yet. I'm kind of starting to get curious now that the platform's kind of gaining. Like, I think, like, the Galaxy S from Samsung has really helped. Like Android actually, I guess, I don't want to call it mainstream, but start to gain a lot more momentum with sales. Yeah, but I mean, like the Mono Droid, they have their package over there. I think, do they have a designer? I can't remember if Google ships a visual designer or not for Android.
They have an emulator, and then they have, I think what I remember, it's all XML-based, so in a way it's kind of XAML-ish, and then I've seen several like websites and programs where you kind of, you know, they'll build out your XML for you, but there's no like inside of Eclipse. I don't believe there's an interface designer in Eclipse.
Yeah. No, the interesting thing about BlackBerry is they're kind of doing like a platform shift. They bought a company called QNX, which builds an operating system, and that's the real-time operating system, and it's going to be the platform for their Playbook, their new tablet. But they're going to be shifting their phones over to that OS as well. And one of the things they announced was they're going to support Adobe Air as a development platform, along with like HTML5, I think. And I imagine their J2ME Java SDK is going to get carried over eventually. But it's kind of interesting that they're doing Air, because I imagine you're going to be able to use like the Adobe tools to build an Air app and put it on the BlackBerry.
Yeah.
Which is going to be a big upgrade for developers, I think.
That's interesting, too. You know, I don't think of BlackBerry all that much, but it's still like a leading mobile platform, right? I mean, that's like, I thought I remembered seeing that was still, is that still the top smartphone platform?
There were some reports a couple weeks ago about iPhone finally surpassing it in the U.S., I think. But yeah, they're definitely like, so they're doing kind of like a technology shift while they're still doing very well, which is a good play, I think, because they've shipped devices like the Storm and Storm 2 that were supposed to, you know, compete against the iPhone, but they're very poor. But yeah, I think they're doing a good play right now. They're switching OSs, which is, you know, that's not a difficult, or that's not an easy decision to make, it to, mm-hmm. you know, trash can the OS that you built and buy a company and then integrate that OS. But I think they're doing a good choice there.
I was curious. So we were talking earlier about, you know, different desktop patterns, differences between operating systems. What are your thoughts on the differences in both usability and then developer-wise on the differences in the kind of desktop approaches on the different phones?
Like the hubs versus home screen type stuff?
Yeah.
I actually really like Microsoft's approach with the hubs. I think it's really neat. The only thing is, I'm a big fan of Metro, but I think there's a couple things on Metro that really bother me. Like the on the is it called the hub screen? I can't remember, or the home screen, or the start screen. Is that arrow that points that you can go to the right? I don't think that needs to be there, and there's like a big margin on the right that's just black. I think they could have just consumed that space with hubs. They didn't really need to make that, you know, right side a big black void. I think people know that you can, you know, use your finger to slide around. I think it would have been interesting, though, to be able to get more screens of hubs. Like, go right, get more hubs, go left, get more hubs. I think that would have been kind of cool. I think the app screen, like the screen that lists the applications, I think that's kind of boring. It's just like a flat list, and it's just a black background. Mm-hmm. So I think they could have maybe done something a little bit more creative there. But the hub screen itself, I think, is whoever designed that, I think that and the panorama experience, I think those people deserve a raise, because they had the challenge of, you know, build something that competes with the iPhone, but don't build the iPhone, build something else. And I think they hit that on, you know, on the nail with those experiences. It's unique and still handy. Kind of like what you were saying about the Alt Tab and Vista, how, you know, they tried to make something neat, but it really wasn't useful. In this case, they you know, tried to compete and build something rich, but they made it useful at the same time.
Yeah, as going back a ways, I've seen people comment on that thing with the margin on the right. In this, you know, the arrow at the top and then nothing below it. And I think since I'd seen enough commentary on that beforehand, I can't look at it without noticing that. It seems like something where it's like, you know, it's important maybe for discoverability when you first start using your phone that you're able to, like, get to your apps. Like, if you never found your apps, and I mean, from watching how, you know, like, friends and family use their computers, I wouldn't be surprised if there were people that never found their apps, if there wasn't some sort of indication. But it might be something that could go away, you know? Like, on first run of your computer or on first run of your phone, there's things that'll say, like, hey, here's this. It's like you're getting started wizard, and then it goes away, you know? And it seems like that arrow could have been something like that.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting idea, that to make, you know, the OS kind of self-teach you how to use it, mm-hmm. but then go away once you actually have done the action a couple times.
I think that XP had this getting started wizard going way back, and I thought it was neat when it first ran, and like by the 100th time I'd installed XP, I was really sick of it.
Yeah.
but yeah, I mean, maybe that idea too, that things just kind of self-teach, like after you've done an action a few times, the computer understands, yeah, you know how to do this, and stops, you know, and gets out of your way a little bit more.
Yeah, I think that they have a lot of room. Like, what they've released, I think, is really good. And, like, it's no secret that they changed strategy kind of midway in the product. And I think they were very, you know, they had a very tight deadline, which was release ASAP. And I think there's probably some things that they just really wanted to do that they couldn't, because they really couldn't feature creep and delay it anymore. So, I think, like, the app screen is probably something like that. They probably said, we have to really nail down certain features like the hub screen and you know, the transitions of going in and out of apps. So I think they focused on that stuff. Like, the camera experience is really good, you know, how you can just press a button and open the camera app.
Yeah.
So I think I think in version, you know, I don't know if you want to call it 2 or 8, it's going to be quite a lot improved from what we see now.
Yeah. You know, the camera is funny because I've had arguments with Nathan Bowers, and we'll have to have him on the show someday. His blog is UX Hero. So he's into user experience, and he hates the idea of a dedicated camera button because he's like, oh, well, do we need a Facebook button? Do you need a, you know, it's like, but to me, I mean, a phone is one thing where it's like, when I want to take a picture, I want to take the picture right now, you know? And it's like, I don't mind clicking around to get some things, but there's like moments where you want a photo, you don't want to, at least for me, I want to do it instantly. And so like that kind of idea of a dedicated phone button is something that I think is important to me. And then like the way the experience works there.
Yeah. I think what they were kind of listening to with that button was, now, what do users want as far as actions? Because that's, you know, really what you're using your phone for. But, yeah, the Facebook or like, tweet, like, you know, I need to tweet something fast. Should there be a button for that? I guess you got to draw the line somewhere.
Right, right. But then I can see that being used as, you know, the argument to draw the line at nothing. You know, but I like having a few small things.
Yeah, I agree.
There's one thing that I was generally happy with when I got my hands on a Windows phone was the transition seemed pretty smooth. Like things scrolled quickly and animation seemed, you know, snappy. Was that your experience too?
I actually haven't had a chance to use a device yet. I've only used the emulator, but
it'll look beautiful.
Yeah, it'd be like silky smooth. But I've seen like the videos like on Engadget and stuff, and you know the minimum requirements I think really really help the platform. You know that 1 gigahertz Snapdragon processor, the thing, you know, looks like it renders at crazy speeds. But the one thing I find a little bit concerning right now is a lot of the reviewers are saying that the OS apps are fast, but the third-party apps are kind of slow. So, but I'm kind of concerned because like the Microsoft apps are built on a native SDK that's not Silverlight, and then the third-party apps are Silverlight. So I'm hoping that, you know, that gets resolved sooner than later.
Yeah.
Because like there's people saying that scrolling is a little bit chunky. I'm sure some of that is people not optimizing their apps because they're new to the platform. And that's one of the biggest challenges when I got into mobile dev was learning to, you know, be really picky about how you're doing things, because it's not a computer. It's not a desktop. It doesn't have, you know, 4 gigs of RAM and 4 cores.
Scott Hanselman did a Hanselminutes with, was it Jeff Wilcox? I forget. I've said this wrong twice now. Let me look it up real quick.
Jeff Wilcox knows a bunch of optimization stuff. When the SDK was released, I think it was the night that it was released, the final version, he went on like a tweet storm where he tweeted like, I don't know, it must have been 150 tips of how to, what you should and should not do with Windows Phone SDK.
Okay, yep, and so that was him, Jeff Wilcox. I should have trusted my feelings. But so on that show, they talk through, you know, here are the counters and here are, you know, specific ways where you can optimize. So that's cool. Did he capture that stuff? You know, it was all on this Twitter rant. Did he? I wonder if this is published.
Actually, it was so good that Tim Hauer actually, he just like aggregated it all and did a blog post on his blog.
Oh, awesome. Okay.
Yeah, it was good stuff. It was like, if you're starting with Windows Phone 7 development, you should just like go to that blog and just write it all down.
Okay. All right. We'll try and get that in the notes then. Are there other, I mean, speaking of, you know, different phone platforms, are there other like complete gotchas where you've seen people make different, I don't know, like performance-wise, are there huge gotchas on other platforms? Other than the obvious, you know, like you don't have unlimited memory, that kind of thing.
It kind of depends on which one you're working on. They're a little bit different. Like, so the iPhone is a simulator, so you have to, there's a difference between simulator and emulator. Simulator, it's not obviously emulating a native platform. It's just running, you know, similar libraries on, you know, the native machine, like an x86 or something like that. So the iPhone simulator runs like, you know, magnitudes faster than the phone. So if you're parsing something like, say, a 5 meg XML file, you're going to think it's going to work great on the phone. And then you're going to put it on the phone and it's going to be, you know, quite a bit slower. But when we used to do that on the Windows mobile emulator, it's not true to the device, but because it's being emulated, you're seeing, you know, a fair bit of performance hit there. So you were already somewhat being conscious of the speed, which was good. The emulator for Windows Phone 7 is quite a bit faster than the emulator that was for Windows Mobile. So you have to kind of be careful there. you just have to get used to really, writing code, trying it on the device every once in a while. And the longer you develop with these platforms, the more you kind of learn what you can and can't do.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Is there any, we've been asking different people that we talked to about mobile platforms about the whole idea of, code portability. And have you ever seen that work in practice where you're able to use code on more than one platform, or is it always just a rewrite every time out?
It's usually a rewrite because before, Mono and them porting their CLR to different platforms, nobody really shared the same language except for Microsoft with WinForms on Windows Mobile and Windows CE and Windows. So you could port some, but there was, the compact framework was missing a lot of APIs compared to the full framework. So basically what we would do is we would have, we would share code bases, but there'd be like a lot of if blocks depending on, we do a compiler directive or saying, this is Windows CE and this is Windows Mobile 6 or 5, this is Windows, and we would, sometimes we'd have to fill the API gaps ourselves for the mobile platforms and just write our own that did, the API that we were missing. But we could share quite a bit in WinForms. It was actually pretty impressive what we could share. Things like XML DOM, like we were even doing XML transforms on phones because, that was included in the compact framework, which was pretty cool. It's not there for Silverlight, though, unfortunately. But as far as like BlackBerry, you can share some Java because it's based on G2ME, which is, it's a standard, and Symbian uses G2ME as well. You can share some stuff, but it's not as big, it's not as shareable as you'd hope. And especially like the UIs, you have to make custom UIs. So I think the guys on the Mono team have probably achieved the most cross-platform, and you still can't share any UI. You could build your own toolkit on top of, those native UI toolkits, but I'm not sure how great that would work. But you can definitely, if you write a REST library for Twitter with the Mono SDK, like Mono Droid and Mono Touch, you could definitely reuse that REST library that you wrote, amongst the different platforms. And I believe their base SDK is their Moonlight one, which is, their Silverlight version. So you could probably share, core pieces of your platform with Windows Phone 7, Mono Touch, and Mono Droid. You just have to build UI. So you just have to structure your app properly, I think. So you can do some sharing, but yeah, there's no write once and just compile for three phones.
Okay, Scott, you got any reaction so far?
I think the new commercials for Windows Phone 7 are smashingly hilarious.
I actually have a comment about that, which is, so there is it the commercial that's called Really, where it's like they want you to be in and out of your phone fast. I love my smartphone. I don't want to be in and out of it fast. I want to use it.
Yeah.
I get their point, though. They're trying to say, like, you can do an action and then you don't have to spend all day on the device to do whatever it is you're doing. But
right. I think for me, too, I really don't mind spending time with my phone. We have quality time together, but I think that it really kind of resonates with people, and people get the idea of like, I don't know, like even if people are like, this isn't, I don't know what I'm saying there. Yeah. Go ahead.
It kind of jives with the camera experience, right? It's like take a picture and then put the phone back into your pocket.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about different kind of platforms, and one that, is an obvious alternative for sharing code and all these different things is the whole, build some sort of HTML experience. Although, I guess then I'm not sure, I haven't done in-depth looking at the Windows Phone browser. I know that it's, based on some older version of IE, but then I read reviews and they'll say, well, it actually rendered all the sites I tried to use over this past week really well. So, but I guess, you don't get the edge HTML5e features then.
Yeah, I don't think it has HTML5 yet. I think it's like a hybrid of IE8, I think, if I remember. So I think it's modern. It just doesn't have the HTML5 stuff.
Yeah.
Does anyone know then if a Windows Phone 7, if you buy one today, is it going to be possible to automatically update pieces of the system, like the browser, in the future?
I think they responded when they did their big unveil, because that was one of the major questions from a lot of people, was like, is it going to be like Android, where updates are up to the carrier and the handset maker, and, you know, some people get Froyo and some people don't. I think they said that updates will be up to Microsoft, and you'll get them, you know, some will be earlier than others, but it'll be like days, not months or never. So I think Microsoft controls more of the update process, which is, it's really key, because OS updates are almost like a feature that keeps people on the platform. It makes people, you know, they feel safe in buying one now, because it's going to continue to get better.
Yeah. And it seems like there's a bit of a conflict of interest there, because the carriers don't want you to upgrade. They want you to buy a new phone, you know, whereas the operating system, yeah, you do want to buy, you know, feel that, like, yes, I'm buying not into just the phone today, but I'm going to have it, you know, like it's going to grow with me or whatever. It's going to get, as other people get cool new phones, my phone's going to get cool new features as well. I forget what specific feature it was, so I'm not going to speculate wildly, but I do remember there was something where they're like, this isn't in Windows Phone as it releases, but there's going to be an update very soon. And I forget, they actually gave some kind of date or time range, and it was very soon. And so that made me really happy for two reasons. One, yes, it's possible to update, and two, like, updates aren't, you know, 2 years apart or whatever, which is forever in phone years. So
yeah, that was copy and paste.
Did you do some questions from Twitter? There were questions on Twitter.
There were questions on Twitter. So we've got, yes, from Twitter we have, unfortunately, none of these are abusive questions, so I can't play the abusive questions from Twitter music, but we do have from Daryl Miller. He asks, when are you going to start doing the virtual brainstorming events?
Oh, yeah, that. do you guys know anything about that, or should I explain it?
Well, you should explain it. I remember reading it, and I thought it sounded like a great idea, but yes, I'm sure somebody hasn't. Go ahead.
Glenn Block, he went to RestFest, and I was kind of watching online. It was pretty neat, actually. It was a small conference, I think like 30 people or something like that, and Daryl Miller set up just a laptop with a webcam, and you could, you know, watch the conference live. It was pretty neat. And I was listening to, so somebody was in between sessions, and they were just sitting around talking, and they were talking about, I can't remember, some sort of feature, and they started just brainstorming about, you know, how they could do this and that. And it was really interesting to listen to, you know, some top REST people, you know, discussing things. And I thought, you know, this is a really great learning experience to, you know, listen to, you know, really smart people discussing a problem, and, you know, the discussion really evolving and going different directions. So I was thinking it'd be really neat if there was like a podcast where you just threw like five people in a conference, like a Skype conference, and just let them like talk about like a topic, like, you know, like we were talking about how you could do some interesting sync scenarios with mobility. So, you know, you can just throw five people in a room and talk about that. How would we solve that, and how would it work and stuff like that? So I did like a twit poll to see if people were interested in doing that, but I'd never done a podcast before, so I thought about just doing yours here first before starting to do my own.
Sure, yeah. Well, I thought too, I mean, and what I had thought when I first read that was kind of also the idea, like, I know Sarah Chips was doing for a while, I don't think she is anymore, but she was doing these LAN parties, and
yeah,
those are definitely more kind of informal, where it's just kind of like people show up and talk, and whoever's there talks. Actually, Daryl Miller's usually on those too, but that's kind of
interesting. Yeah, I've been on them a couple times.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the biggest challenge, so, like, I was thinking about it, and I was like, I want to maybe just do like a pilot episode to see how it was going to work. So I was trying to think of a topic to debate about, and it's really hard to find a topic that people can talk about openly because their company's not working on something like that already.
Yeah. No comment. No, yeah. It's definitely been an interesting challenge. For all of us, we were under different NDAs beforehand, but then now also when I'm working for Microsoft, I have to think, not only, you know, is there something I'm not supposed to talk about, but then also, you know, if You know, if I say this, does that mean that Kevin Dente is dead?
Yeah, a brainstorming podcast wouldn't work very well if people can't talk about anything.
Right. Hence herding code. Well, so we had another question from Jackson H., who said, I wonder who that guy is, who said, he had two questions. One is, what is the most interesting thing you've learned in the past month?
That's a tough one. I think he's probably curious to see if I picked the thing that we were talking about on Twitter. I think it was last week. he was talking about, I'm not sure how it started. He was discussing Node.js and what Node.js is. And so I watched a conference from, I guess, the guy who created it. And I learned about, I can't remember what they're called, but I think they're generally called I.O. threads.
Mm-hmm.
And how requests would come in on the I.O. threads, and it's better to use I.O. threads opposed to, you know, regular threads. And so I was also chatting to Clemens Vasters of Service Bus at the same time, and he was like, you know, those have existed in Windows NT since like 1994. They're called I.O. completion ports. So I learned, like, I didn't even know these existed, that there were, you know, different types of threads in the kernel and stuff like that. So I found it really interesting, and then I just started reading up on, like, OS X and how they do similar things. And they called them, what do they call them? Mock threads, I think, on OS X. And apparently these things are really key for doing, like, parallel or concurrent services. Like, so Apache, I guess, doesn't scale as well as it could because it doesn't use I.O. threads. And so I think that's probably the most significant thing that I've learned.
Yeah, Apache uses a process per request, isn't it? I think. And that's why it...
I think so.
So people say that it falls apart quickly, but, you know, you think about how many high-volume sites are running under Apache. And maybe they're running on just really big servers. But, you know, they seem to be holding up rather well.
Yeah. Well, regular threads take more memory, too.
Now, I remember this whole thing of fibers as well, but I think those are different than the whole kind of completion ports. Like, a fiber is a very lightweight thread.
Yeah, fiber's different.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you the exact difference off the top of my head, but there's definitely a difference in the way that it's created and, I believe, destroyed.
And then also, I mean, the main thing with Node.js is the whole, like, eventing and how threads are signaled and that kind of thing.
So the big difference between fibers and threads are that threads use preemptive multitasking.
Mm.
Fibers use co-opera multitasking.
Right.
So that's why there's not that big of an issue with synchronicity and locks and all that with fibers. So there we go. Now we know. And knowing is half the battle.
Yes.
But what was interesting, and here's another tangent for us. Recently here on Ajaxian, they had there was a company that was working on Node.js, and had they hadn't forked it necessarily, but they had their own, it's on GitHub, so they fork it and they work on it. And in theirs, they were actually adding fibers into Node.js so that you could start up new fibers from within 1 year callbacks. I thought that was interesting. I thought that was kind of full circle too, but.
Hmm.
What I know about multi-threaded, you not could fit in concurrency.
Hey, wait a minute. So while we're talking about that, did you have any thoughts about the at PDC, the async stuff, the await keyword and all that business?
I thought it was really cool. So I saw that session, and I think it's going to take a while for it to soak in a little bit. Like, it's a different pattern of, although it's like writing synchronous code, just marking it to be asynchronous, but it's still different. It's a different way of thinking how you're going to structure things. So I think it's going to take a bit to soak in, but I think it's really interesting because I like it a lot better than doing, you know, lambdas and, you know, anonymous delegates and stuff like that. So it's just, I'm trying to picture, you know, if you have a whole ton of callbacks, how easy it is to follow it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to have a whole bunch of async and awaits that cascade.
I think the one place that I was thinking that it would be, because like you're saying, it really is synchronous. It's just simplifies the pattern. Well, it's asynchronous, but it simplifies the code that you're writing for cases like in Silverlight, where everything is like callbacks, you know, and you request a resource and you get it. It's everything is async. And so the code you have to write, you're constantly writing all these events and like you're saying, the delegates, and it just gets to be a pain. And so I could see using that more there.
I think it's definitely going to be useful in those cases. I'm just curious on the more complicated ones. But some of the scenarios he showed in the session was actually pretty interesting, how he took synchronous code and just made it asynchronous. And it had a couple levels in it, I think, like two or three. So it was working. So I think it's just a mindset that you have to use. It's kind of like when Link first came on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
People weren't really used to it. And a lot of people thought it was really interesting. But now, like, you know, at work, I'm seeing it, you know, scattered throughout different code bases. So it just takes time to catch on, I think.
Yeah.
But along that lines, I watched also, because I thought that was super cool. So I thought, well, I'd go watch a session that was just on parallelism. Mm-hmm. So I watched the Parallel Goes Mainstream session, where they talked about tasks and how you can build more complicated parallelism, and it would, you know, try and it had what they call it, task stealing, so it would try and maximize your core usage, and I thought that was another library that would be really useful.
Kevin, K. Scott, did you guys have any thoughts on either the async or the parallelism stuff? No, they've entered a race condition.
I'm blocked waiting for Kevin.
I'm blocked waiting for Case Cut.
And this concludes this episode.
I'm on a fiber, so I can go whenever I want.
Nerd humor. That was it? That was your comments, guys? Sad.
What do I think of the C-Sharp 5 feature?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's going to be good. I mean, these are things we can do now pretty easily with like continuation passing, but that's sort of an artificial way to solve the problem using the language. So it's kind of nice just to have something built in so the things aren't, again, artificially separated.
Okay, so the real question that I have about the async and all that stuff is, how many days until it shows up in the mono night lease? Who's got the over-under on it?
Yeah.
On. Anyone,
I'm going to guess probably like a month, maybe?
Yeah, I was going to say a month.
You think? I don't know. If I bet at some point Miguel will find some need for it in Moonlight, and it will make it in like 24 hours.
Right.
From the time that he needs it.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes those guys just hack stuff overnight, and then it just shows up the next morning.
Yeah. Yep.
Like I saw a tweet from Jeff. And he was like, got JavaScript running on the iPhone, running it on the CLR. And I'm like, what?
Yeah, yep. Yeah, and I noticed he's got Manos, whatever it's called, running on the on Windows now, which is interesting. Because he didn't before when we talked to him only a couple of weeks ago.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, about this async thing, I was noting, like, there was Eric Lippert had this blog post or blog series leading up to that talking about continuation passing, and it was like, you can do this and you can do this, but it only gets us this far and it's a lot of code. Wow, that's ugly, you know. So it was like not a huge, I mean, it definitely things fell into place when you saw the await keyword. Like it was all, you could do that using other patterns before, but it was more code, and you know, this is simplifies things. I was chatting with Matt Podwasaki about how he thought this related in with reactive extensions, you know, and the whole, like, you know, this is obviously like kind of smaller in scale because this doesn't, like reactive extensions, you've got kind of the whole, you know, stream of events, and you're reacting to, you know, a lot of different, like you specify a bunch of things. It's more declarative. You know, you're saying these are my, this is how I'll react to this event, this event, this event, and, you know, iterate over the stream. And whereas this is kind of like for, you know, get here and await this and then do this. It's, but what Matt's comment was, this will solve a lot of cases. You know, this is the 90% solution, which is nice.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think it's some of the other stuff, like the Parallel 4 and Parallel Invoke, that stuff looks interesting too. I really want to try it and just do like Parallel 4 on some of my stuff just to see if it actually makes a difference.
Yeah. I end up...
I'm trying to find... Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, back on the async keyword, I'm trying to find this blog post that was really good, and it came out exactly on the same day that they released the CTP. But the gist of the blog post was that async doesn't necessarily mean what everyone thinks that it means. Do you guys remember who it was that wrote that? Mm-hmm. I thought it was Lucian, but I can't see it there now. Now I will never find it. No one will believe me.
You make stuff up.
I just dreamed this up.
Yeah.
Anyway.
If those are your dreams, they're kind of sad.
One too many head jumps.
Too many head jumps. I did have a dream about ex-running back and Hall of Famer Jim Brown selling me a bookshelf on a garage in Albuquerque. I don't know why.
Everyone has that dream.
I mean, at least I wasn't naked, I guess, which is good. Because that would have been weird.
Yeah.
Because selling you a bookshelf isn't too weird, right?
Apparently Jim Brown doesn't need to read anymore. I don't know.
He's got people to do that for him. So we're at like an hour and a half-ish, which, you know, edits down a little bit, but...
Kevin always runs us over.
That's right.
Yeah.
He waits till the... Oh, wait a minute!
See? That...
All right.
So one comment about the async thing, which I haven't really had much of a chance to look at that stuff in too much depth yet. So basically just read a couple blog posts. But one thing that just seemed interesting to me is that, you know, the async stuff is sort of like syntactic sugar to make asynchronous code look synchronous, right?
My question is that going to work on previous frameworks? Like, does it require a new .NET framework?
Gosh, I think from what I...
Like a new version of the CLR?
No, I don't think so. I think I remember reading like post... Well, I'm going to sound stupid. I think I remember that this is an async CTP, so it was something where you can like try this out, download this and run it today kind of thing.
Yeah, is it a compiler replacement? I wasn't clear on that. I haven't installed it.
I think
it
was a library.
Is it just a library?
You see, that blog post that I'm talking about what the CTP was do, and now I cannot find it.
Yeah, and see, like, if it's a new keyword, my thought doesn't really make a lot of sense.
I'm pretty sure that's all syntactic sugar. It just funks down into stuff that gets generated against the TPL.
Yeah, so then it would, in order to get syntactic sugar, you need a new compiler, right?
But that means it can run against .NET 4?
I don't know.
Well, it might be able to run on the .NET 4 CLR, but I'm not sure. It'd require, you know, at least a new version of the C# language.
Yeah.
Right. I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
Because I think when you open it up with Reflector, I think you'll just see it's transformed it into calls that involve task and continue with and continuation passing.
Well, so now, wait a minute. I'm reading, because everyone loves to listen to reading on a podcast. But I think there's the syntactic sugar part, but then... I am seeing here, download the CTP, open Visual Studio 2010, create a Silverlight 4 project, copy these DLLs in, and, you know, here's some code. And then they've got this await keyword. So,
So that means it can run, that was Silverlight 4, you said?
Yeah.
So that means it'll run on the existing Silverlight 4 runtime.
Yeah, I guess. Maybe since this is a Visual Studio async CTP, maybe this is actually adding in new... changing the compiler and changing Visual Studio as well.
Oh, maybe
anyway, selling you a bookshelf.
So where I was going with my original...
That's all the time we have.
It's interesting to me that, you know, you compare that approach to something like Node.js, which is just sort of takes async, you know, like into its heart, if you know what I mean. Everything is... you know, done via callbacks. It doesn't try to mask it or bury it in any way. It just sort of embraces it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of the opposite. They adopted JavaScript because it does callbacks very well.
So I thought that was an interesting difference in perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that seems similar to a lot of things with C#. Like C# is statically typed, and it's more kind of, you know, and then you get syntactic sugar, which gives you these kind of, you know, dynamicism and asynchronicity and all this kind of stuff, but it does it in a, you know, these are like it's sugar on top. But then on the other hand, you do get to keep your static typing and your, you know, other kind of stuff if you like. So, but yeah, I don't know. All right. Should we wrap up?
Oh, I'm just getting started.
Okay, what else you got?
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Okay, so Kelly, we always do this thing at the end of the show where you have the opportunity to pimp your stuff. So if you're speaking anytime soon, if you're, you know, I don't know, if you have anything you'd like to tell our listeners about, you're welcome to.
Pretty much just check out my blog at kelabyte.com and or my Twitter, which is at kelabyte. That's pretty much all I got.
All right. Awesome.
And thank you very much for having me on the show.
Thank you very much. Yeah, this was a lot of fun.